Welcome to Steppin' Out, a reality radio show where you'll hear real people sharing their true stories of what it was like to go over the edge and find their way back. And now, Steppin' Out.
Welcome to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Denise McEntee, your host. And as you know, if you've listened to this show, you'll hear true stories of people every week who come on and really share from the bottom of their hearts how they overcame adversity in their lives, but have come out on the other side. And I'm excited today because we really have a powerhouse of a woman who's going to tell her story. But she's written so many books and she has helped so many people worldwide. But I'll let her tell you all about that. But her latest book is called Living Long, Living Passionately, 75 and Counting, in parentheses, Ways to Bring Peace and Purpose to Your Life. And if you want to check out, her name is Karen Casey. And if you want to check out her website, it's www.womens-spirituality.com. And it's plural, womens-spirituality.com. And again, the book is Living Long, Living Passionately. But Karen Casey, as I said, has written so many books. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Karen to Steppin' Out Radio. Welcome.
Oh, thanks, Denise. I just love the opportunity to be with you. Being present to an opportunity like this that maybe will help other people to decide that they want to make some different choices for their lives is really what my work is all about these days. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
Your work and your books, oh my God, you're such a prolific writer. Your books are awesome. But on Steppin' Out Radio, Karen, I'd love to hear, and so would the listeners, your personal story of recovery and how you changed. So if you could begin at the beginning, how did it start for you?
Okay, thanks. I was born in Indiana, Lafayette, Indiana. And I was the third child in a family of four children, two older sisters and a younger brother. And it was a family that was rife with problems, like so many families are. Nobody talked about dysfunctional families back then, but it certainly was a family that was riddled with dysfunction. My father was non-alcoholic, nor was my mother, but my father was a rageaholic. And it created the same kind of dynamic in the family if that would have been the case had he been alcoholic, because we found ourselves tiptoeing around all the time in hopes of not setting him off, not enraging him over something. And that was pretty much impossible because most days he came home from work angry about something. And so from the time I was a kid, a real little kid, I used to try to watch very closely the expressions of other people, particularly of my parents, to see what was going to happen next. And I somehow felt as though, and I don't think this is really uncommon for people who end up with problems with alcohol or drugs, I somehow felt that if I could just figure out the perfect thing to do, I could keep them from tearing each other apart, because that's what generally happened. There was just a terrible battle over nothing, and then all of us were affected by it. So I was always trying to figure out if there was something I could do to change that. What I finally discovered that seemed to change it, for me at least, was alcohol at the age of 13. And I took my first drink of alcohol at a family gathering. And it was easy to do because there was always alcohol present, even though neither of my parents were alcoholic. But there were plenty of alcoholics throughout the rest of the family, though. And so alcohol was always very accessible. And when I took that first drink of Coke and whiskey at the age of 13, I had an immediate sense of well-being. And it was as though this is the solution to the problem. you know, that at least it would alleviate the constant anxiety I felt as a result of being in a family where anger and tension was so ever present. And I had tried, you know, to modify my dad's behavior, really. I had really tried to stick up for my mom. Yeah. I had tried all kinds of things as a kid, as I think sometimes there's always one child in the family that does think that he or she can alleviate whatever is going on. But nothing I had ever done made anything any better and probably exacerbated the situation, in fact. But
what about your sisters? Did they ever try?
Well,
or,
you know,
or your brother?
You know, my older sisters seemed to just kind of skate through. They seemed relatively unscathed mm-hmm. by the behavior of my dad. And my younger brother got the brunt of it, he and my mother both. And mm-hmm. so I really felt like I needed to be the protector of each of them. And my younger brother was so bullied by my dad, actually, that by the time he was 20, he was really a mess. He never, ever took a drink in his life, never took a drug in his life, but he had a full-blown nervous breakdown when he was about 20 years old. And it was really the result of simply not being able to measure up in any way to the expectations that my dad had had of him. My dad had had those expectations really of all of us, but my brother, I think, suffered. He and my mother both suffered the most from those expectations. What they did to me was simply made me angry. And so I ended up, you know, being appalled at my dad's anger and turning out to be angry just like him. And so for a lot of years, he and I were really trapped in this dance that we did, and it was a dance that was really fueled by his anger and by my anger, which is also, though, you know, when I had alcohol in me, it was as though I could kind of ignore the circumstances around me. And so alcohol really gave me a great deal of courage in so many instances. I've often thought, you know, I ended up later in my life getting a PhD in American Studies from the University of Minnesota. And I have often said, and I really believe this to be true, that the alcohol fueled my courage even in that pursuit.
Right.
So alcohol, you know, alcohol has a way of doing a lot for us until it no longer works for us at all. And, of course, that's every recovering alcoholic story. Finally, the alcohol or the drugs quit working. But for a lot of years, the alcohol seemed to develop in me a person that I don't think I could have been on my own. And I made that discovery at age 13, that alcohol was doing something for me that seemed pretty spectacular.
But how did life go for you? You know, you got your doctorate, so obviously life was going good, you know, educationally. But what happened next?
Well, you know, prior to that period of time, what also happened for me was that not only did I get addicted to alcohol and what it would do for me, but I also found myself very focused on having boys and then men in my life. So that my addiction, I think, was as strong to alcohol as it was, as strong to men as it was to alcohol. You know, we talk about codependence. That's become a very popular term. And I really have a feeling that not only was I born with a proclivity to be alcoholic, but certainly I was born with a proclivity to be very codependent too. I was always trying to find somebody else that would make me feel as though I was important or I was valued. And that's such a deadly thing for a young girl, to always be looking to somebody else for some kind of sense that she had a worthiness that she didn't feel was natural to her at all. And so from the time I was in high school, you know, I was always on the search for the perfect boyfriend that would make me feel good. And of course, I carried this right into college. And my first husband, and this is really all part of how I ultimately got into AA too, but my first husband was just as riddled with the need to drink as I was, and it, which of course made him the perfect selection.
Right.
You know, I met him in a biology class, and I was immediately attracted to him. We were at Purdue University, that's where I did my undergraduate work, and I was immediately attracted to him because he was so cute and he was really smart, and there were a lot of us young women in the class who felt as though if we followed him around, we could get all the answers to all the lab questions we needed. And but then I really felt like I scored because I got him interested in me. And the first time he came to my house to pick me up for a date, I was pleasantly surprised to discover not only was he cute and smart, but he had a red Buick convertible.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I really have, I really struck gold this time. That's how I felt.
Right.
And so to be able to marry him ultimately seemed like the solution, because not only then would I have this man in my life that would give me a sense of security, but somebody that loved to drink just like I did, and somebody who was fun and cute and smart. You know, I mean, it was like everything, and with a red Buick convertible. So we got married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it made perfect sense. We got married. What I didn't know at the time that we got married was that he had a major problem with being faithful. And so our marriage, our 12-year marriage, was riddled with infidelities galore.
Mm.
I didn't know that all that was happening early in the marriage, but it didn't. We weren't very many years into it before I was confronted with the truth of what our marriage was. But I also was so fearful, really, of the whole idea of being without him, of being rejected, that seemed really worse than trying to live with who he was. And I think that, you know, that's probably hard to understand for a lot of the listeners. But in that era, you know, I graduated from high school in 1957. I'm 76 years old now. At that time, that's, you know, that was one of the things that lots of women put up with because they simply didn't want to be the rejected wife, the woman left behind. And so, and besides, I thought that if I confronted it and left him, that my parents, because of the era they grew up in, my parents would likely say to me, "What did you do wrong?"
Mm.
And so to simply tolerate the situation was what I felt I had to do. And, you know, when you are at the same time quieting your own nerves, your own anxieties with alcohol as often as I was doing it, you know, it made you feel as though you could live through almost anything. Well, as it turned out, it wasn't to be, because he decided after 12 years that he wanted to leave me for somebody else.
Mm.
And I was devastated. In spite of all he had done, I was absolutely devastated that now I was to face life alone. At that same time, though, Denise, I had been teaching elementary school for 8 years. We had moved from Indiana, from Lafayette, to Minneapolis, Minnesota, so that he could pursue a PhD in American Studies. And during all of this craziness in our marriage, I decided that maybe what I would do is pursue graduate school too, because perhaps that would make me more interesting to him if I was something more than a third grade teacher. The insanity of that can only be understood, you know, by somebody who has gone through the craziness of alcoholic living and then getting recovery, to look back on that and see, oh my God, the insanity of that. But the beauty too, and I have come to believe, and this is a core belief for me and has been for many years now, because I've been in the rooms now for over 40 years. So one of my core beliefs is that everything that happens in our lives is absolutely perfect. Everything that has happened in our lives is part of what we have needed to experience to get where we're going to be next. And so when I look back on my whole time with Bill and my deciding to go to graduate school, it all fits so beautifully, because after he left me, I was doing incredibly well in graduate school. I ended up being a straight A student, which was a phenomenal surprise to me, because I was not, and I had not been, I had been a C plus student as an undergraduate. So this was such a surprise to me that I would end up being able to accomplish this in graduate school.
And what happened next?
Well, you know, when I, it was such a surprise to me that that's how it was working out. And again, when I think that everything really in our lives does work out perfectly, it's as though God was doing for me what I could not have done for myself at that period of time. You know, it was as though I was on a trajectory that was very planned, and all I was doing was showing up. And it feels so good to have that belief, because it convinces me that the rest of my life will continue in that same fashion. But at any rate, I was doing great in school. I was teaching at the university at the same time. But my personal life, as you can imagine, was a shambles, because I was drinking alcoholically every single night. You know, I would go to campus and teach my classes. I would write my papers for graduate school. That was an utterly amazing experience for me, because it really is what initiated in me the desire to be a writer, because for some unknown reason at the time, I would sit down to write a paper and it would simply flow. Every other graduate student I knew, including my first husband, who never did finish his PhD because he had accumulated so many incompletes, everybody I knew struggled with the paper writing part of graduate school. And, you know, graduate school, that's what it is. It's a paper every class plus a gigantic dissertation at the end of the entire coursework. And for me, it was just like, I don't even know how to describe it. I would sit down to write and things just seemed to tumble forth from me. At any rate, I just flew through graduate school as a straight A student.
Karen, you did know, you get hangovers?
I never, ever woke up in the morning so hungover that I could not, that a little brandy in my coffee wouldn't get me right back on the horse. And so I just kind of miraculously.
You just did it. Okay.
I did it. I simply did it. And I think that for a lot of people, alcohol works for them for a very long time, mm-hmm. until that point when it doesn't work anymore. But while I was after Bill left and I was drinking and partying and teaching and writing papers and meeting men where I shouldn't have been. But the good part of all of that was that that's how I ended up in the rooms of Al-Anon. one of the last men that I had gotten involved with went through treatment, and his counselor said to me, referred to me as the co-alcoholic, not knowing that in fact I was indeed every bit as much of an alcoholic as mm-hmm. John had been. But he said to me, you need to go to Al-Anon if you want to save this relationship. And of course, having a relationship was of primary importance to me. So I went off to Al-Anon, and I thought, this is going to make it perfect. And of course, it didn't, because, you know, my attempt to make that relationship perfect was not meant to be anyway. But I went to Al-Anon, and that very first meeting, I sat there and I thought, my heavens, you know, I'd never experienced anything like that. And I saw people who were talking in ways that I had never heard people share before. I saw people who simply showed a love and a concern for each other, and I had never seen that before. I had never grown up with that in my family. I had never seen that anyplace. And that very first meeting, they sent me home with the little book, One Day at a Time in Al-Anon. And this was in 1974. And I went home and I thought, oh my gosh, this is such a simple little book. I mean, I'll just read this from cover to cover and figure it all out and save our relationship and everything will be just fine. And in fact, I went back to the Al-Anon meeting the following week, and the people in the group remembered me, of course, and said, well, how are you? And I said, I'm just fine. I finished the book. And they all laughed and said, you know, now you might notice that the title of the book is One Day at a Time in Al-Anon. And actually, all you want to do, all you need to do is read one page per day mm-hmm. as a way of finding peace and serenity in your life. Mm-hmm. And the thing, too, I think about that, Denise, as one of God's funny little jokes on me, because it was not very many years after that I wrote my very first book, which also was a daily meditation book, just like One Day at a Time in Al-Anon. My first book was Each Day a New Beginning, Daily Meditations for Women. That was published in 1982. Wow. So, you know, it feels, when I look back on my life, it feels as though all of the foundation blocks were being so beautifully laid out for me. I was unaware of where they were leading, but the God of my understanding certainly was not unaware of where I was being led. I ended up, though, in AA, fortunately, because that relationship, we ended up surviving for a while, but we ended up in counseling for couples. And you know, again, this was the perfect door opener, because we were in the counseling group and we were to show up for 6 weeks. There were six couples, and each week a couple shared their story. And the very first week I showed up, John did not show up. But because of being such a good codependent, I had the perfect excuse for why he couldn't be there. I had no idea he wasn't going to show up, but I didn't want them to know that.
Sure.
So I made up a great excuse. Week two, he didn't show. Week three, he didn't show. Week four, week five, and week six, he never showed. And every time I made what I thought was a reasonable excuse as to why he was interviewing for a new job, he was, you know, there was one excuse after another that I manufactured so that I wouldn't look like I was involved with somebody who didn't care about me and didn't care about us.
Sure.
And on that sixth meeting, the counselor said, you know, Karen, I'm not so sure you're in a relationship. And she wasn't trying to be cruel, but it kind of hit me, you know, like, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, he really isn't here. He doesn't show up. And so then she said, tell us your story. And we've heard from everybody else. And I started to tell a bit about my life and sharing a bit about my alcohol use. And she interrupted me and said, you know, Karen, I'm thinking that you need another program in your life besides Al-Anon. I think you should try AA. And she asked if anybody in the group would take me to a meeting. And three people raised their hands, and we made a plan to meet the following Monday. And that's how I ended up at my very first AA meeting in May of 1976. And it was. I mean, I walked in, and I it was kind of like the first time I had gone to Al-Anon. I walked in, and I couldn't believe my eyes. I thought, I looked around, and it was a room of about 200 people. I was just ecstatic because there were way more men than women, and I thought, oh, this is just perfect. You know, I mean, John is perhaps the loser the counselor thinks he is, but here is a room full of replacements.
There you go.
And yeah, and I, you know, I loved that first meeting. I didn't understand any of it, but I felt hopeful. What I was really hopeful for was that I would find another relationship partner. Oh. I found so much more than that. But that night, when the meeting ended, a man walked up to me and he said, I noticed you were a newcomer. And I was thrilled that he noticed. And he said, I hope I see you here again next week. And I left walking like I was on a pink cloud. I thought that was code from him for saying, I really would like to start a relationship with you.
So what happened next?
Well, you know, I spent that whole week after that first meeting literally imagining what my relationship with that man would be like, and that it would, in my mind, I was sure it was going to lead to marriage. And so I eagerly went back to the meeting the following week only to notice him over in the corner talking to another woman, and I was devastated because in my mind, he had already made a commitment to me. And here he was already being what I felt was unfaithful.
Like your
he
first
was talking
husband, right?
To somebody else, like Bill had been.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I had had my share of men between Bill and this point in time with men who really were far less than they wanted me to think they were. And so here he was talking to somebody else, and he hardly acknowledged me. He nodded in my direction. Well, how fortunate that that was the case, because two women, in essence, came up to me and said, you know, we'd like to meet for dinner. We'd like to tell you how this whole thing works. And that was the best thing that could have happened to me. You know, what I realized very early in AA was that most of the people in Minneapolis had gone into treatment. And, you know, I had not gone that route because, number one, I didn't have any idea I was going to end up there. And number two, I didn't have any insurance to pay for treatment.
Wow.
So for me, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous.
Sure.
And because you can get sober with Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to go through treatment. But at any rate, they really saved me because they taught me the ropes, and they said, what you're going to do for that first year is learn how to be friends with women. You're going to hang out with women, and you'll learn to be friends with men, but you're not going to be involved in a relationship. And I, honest to God, couldn't conceive of spending a whole year outside of a relationship. And I thought, my gosh, this is the perfect place to get another relationship. Look at all these men. And they were just insistent. Why I listened to them, I really don't know.
Hmm.
But I did so much want the social aspect. I mean, I've said this many times when I tell my story. I really think that I got sober as much on the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous as anything else. Because initially,
right?
You know, I mean, we did so many things together. We did everything together, all of us, and all of us who were young in AA, and not young in years as much as just young in AA. In our early years, we socialized together. We went to tons of meetings together, and that was exactly what I needed to discover that there was another way.
Start, because I want to talk about your book,
well, you know,
Living Long, Living
Right.
Passionately.
Well, you know, in those early years, even though I was loving every aspect of it, I struggled to find a connection to a higher power and the way other people seemed to find that connection. And I began to write in a different fashion, not just the kind of writing I had done throughout graduate school, but I began journaling. But my journaling is really what turned into that very first book, Each Day a New Beginning, because I was on such a search for a higher power that that's what I wrote about. And that, and all of that writing, I mean, it's, I ended up getting a job actually at Hazelden because I said, I told somebody that what I wanted to do with my life was to be a writer. And he said, you should go to Hazelden. And by this time I had been sober about 3 years. I went out to Hazelden. I said, would you hire me to be a writer? And they said, absolutely not. We don't hire writers. But I kept writing. And the man who was president of Hazelden at that time, he and I became friends. And he asked me about my life. And I told him that I was writing as a way of finding my higher power. And he asked to see what I was writing, and I shared it with him. And that is how Each Day a New Beginning was published. He took one, yes, and that just, from that point on, it led, I left Hazelden so that I could continue writing, but I simply had found a way to make sense of my life and to do something for others in the process. You know, it felt like I was compelled to write. They're really essays. I mean, they're really essays about various topics that can help people to continue to find meaning and purpose in their lives.
And they're so great. They're like, you know, step aside and experience a miracle in the making, or impacting those around you and fulfilling your potential, and so many more. And it's terrific because you read this and you're like, wow, yeah, no, that makes sense, you know, what to do today. And so tell us a little bit about, you know, what made you write this particular book and what we can expect from it. Yeah.
This was actually book number 29.
Wow.
And because I am now 76 years old, I was 75 when I started writing this.
Amazing.
But I felt like I was in this transitional phase for myself and a lot of people, because people are retiring oftentimes earlier than before, and this is the baby boomer generation. And I thought, you know, people sometimes retire and then their lives lack meaning or purpose. And so I ended up knowing that I wanted my own life to continue, even at the age of 75, to be as purposeful as it always has been. And so I sat down and I felt once again just compelled to start writing some essays about how to continue to find peace and purpose in everyday living. And the book just wrote itself, Denise. And I would have to say that's true of every single book I have written. It's as though the idea would come to me and I would sit down, and it was the same for that dissertation I wrote in graduate school. It just has had a flow. It's as though this higher power of mine says, you know, Karen, this is what we need to do next. That's how it honestly feels to me. And so this book evolved in that very same way. It's like, I want my life to be full and rich and rewarding, and I believe other people do too. And I believe that people, as they transition through their life, they don't want to wake up one day and feel as though, gosh, it's over, because it's never over. But this book is designed to help people in short little essays become thoughtful about their own personal daily practices. And so I have provided questions to get people thinking about things that they can continue to do in their own life so that they can help bring purpose to others as well. And so, and the reason it's titled 75 and Counting is because I was thinking of my own age at that time. 75, and I'm 75 and counting is what I said to people. You know, because I expect that I'm going to be alive into my 90s. And I think so. And so I want my life to be as full of hope and good cheer and good deeds then as it has been up to now.
And the other thing I think is important for who's ever listening, this is a book for anybody. It's not just a book for people who are looking for recovery or anything like that. I mean, it's just chock full of such good ideas, and it makes you really think, you know, and it's really important. I mean, you have things like overcoming fear and, you know, it's just terrific. Shaping your mind, your mission statement, all these great things. So I urge everybody to go get it. I really do. I love it.
Oh, thank you, Denise. You know, I just opened up the book just at random myself right now, and it's on essay 30, and it's in the title of the essay is Make Yourself Smile. And I quote Jimmy Fallon, and Jimmy Fallon, and I heard him say, it's really a paraphrase, but I heard him say one night on his show, putting a smile on someone's face before they fall asleep is all I hope to do. If I can do that, I will feel like I have been successful. And in this essay, I go on and talk about, you know, we don't have to do something absolutely great every day. We can do something as tiny as smile at somebody so that they know that they have been witnessed by us, and that brings a great sense of joy and peace to others, and it brings peace to our lives too.
And you certainly
have touched somebody else.
I'm sorry, and you certainly have done that. You've touched millions throughout the world, and you're going to touch more from this radio show. So I thank you really from the bottom of my heart for being with us. Check out Karen's.
Thank you, Denise.
Thank you. You're amazing. Check out Karen's website, womens-spirituality.com. Be sure to pick up her book. These 75 thoughts really are great. So thank you, Karen, and we'll see you next time when we go stepping out. Take care.